In the final months of the Iran-Iraq war, thousands of Kurds were killed in a deadly chemical attack on the remote Iraqi village of Halabja. Each side accused the other of carrying out the attack, but the evidence pointed to Saddam Hussein's forces. The West pretty much looked the other way, and the use of gas against civilians continued. Jost Hilterman explores how this happened and what it means for the Middle East today in his new book, A Poisonous Affair. It's published by Cambridge, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jost Hilterman to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Why did you choose the attack on Halabja for special attention when there were so many other attacks during the Iran-Iraq war involving chemical weapons?
That's right. There was 5 years long chemical weapons were being used. But this was the first time when a major population center, not a village, but a town of 70, 80,000 people targeted directly with chemical weapons. This has never happened in history.
And how did you first learn about this attack on Halabja?
Well, I could have learned about it by just reading the papers back in March 1988, but I was involved in other issues and it just sort of was not on my screen. And I learned about it when I first visited Kurdistan in very late 1991, and people started telling me about it.
Well, you could have read about it in the papers, as you say, but it really didn't get all that much play, despite the fact that it's a rather shocking event. In fact, the use of chemical weapons didn't get much of a play in the newspapers around the world at the time either. Why do you think that is? Because we've only seen chemical weapons used sparingly throughout the history of warfare.
Well, part of it was that there was a war going on between two countries that were notoriously closed. And so access to the war front was very difficult. Reports seeped out, but that was about it. Secondly, Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iran. Nobody cared about Iran. The Iranians were hostage takers, right? And more importantly, Iraq was an ally of the United States in this war. And so there was no real interest in highlighting the abuses of this regime.
But there had been chemical warfare in World War I, and then, at least in theory, although it did pop up in other situations, it and biological warfare were pretty much eliminated as weapons from that point on. Why did Saddam use it? Is it just a cheap way to fight a war?
It was a very important weapon for him because what he faced was something that he had not anticipated, which was these massive hordes, these human waves of fanatical fighters, infantry fighters from the Iranian regime, who threw themselves into minefields and towards the Iraqi gunners' positions. And the gunners would machine guns, they would fire their bullets, and these guys kept coming. Eventually, these guns would jam from overheating, and so they had no real response, and they thought then of chemical weapons.
It must have also taken a heavy psychological toll on the soldiers shooting at these human waves. It was mostly kids coming at them.
Yeah, often it was kids. The Iranians threw kids into these minefields.
Why that kind of tactic, which will cause such massive casualties of your own soldiers?
Well, there were a lot of people who were willing to die. The Iranians knew that the Iraqis had air superiority. They had armor superiority. But one thing they didn't have was superiority in numbers. And the Iranians could just throw their population at Iraq and hope to prevail.
So Saddam decides to use gas, but he already had these chemical weapons, didn't he? When did he institute the program to develop them?
Well, in the 1970s, and the Soviet Union certainly helped in that. So the origins of the program were already there. And the start of the Iran-Iraq war, which started with the invasion of Iran by Iraq in 1980, then the Iraqis started really developing these chemical weapons and really developed their own indigenous capability.
Well, during World War I, mustard gas was used. What was used here?
Well, mustard gas in great amounts for the full 5 years. But in addition to that, Iraq is the first nation on Earth, and so far the only one, to have used nerve agents.
And nerve gas dissipates quickly, so it can be used on the front lines without affecting your own soldiers.
Well, no, it did affect their own soldiers because they used it, but while it did dissipate, they couldn't control the wind. And so there were many, many friendly fire, if you want to call them that, casualties on the Iraqi side. And they used mustard gas for the rear positions of the Iranians so that the fleeing Iranians from the front line would end up in this hanging cloud of mustard gas, which is highly persistent. But also because of the persistence problem, the Iraqis started developing VX, which is a very lethal nerve agent that does hang around. So they were really on their way to develop very nasty weapons, and they were also going to develop biological weapons.
Did they develop their chemical weapons program to the point where it became more effective than conventional weapons?
Well, for these particular offensives, they were very effective. And the Iraqis didn't really care if their own soldiers were harmed as well. They had also protective suits, of course, but they didn't really care. And so, it was effective in the sense that it terrified the Iranians up to a point. And then they became very capable in terms of their own protection. And then these attacks were less effective. And then the regime shifted the use of chemical weapons to the civilian populations.
Since most countries had signed on to an agreement that precluded using chemical weapons, what was the reaction of the West to these tactics?
Well, that is what's so shocking. There was, in fact, barely any response to it. The Security Council was mostly in favor of the Iraqi war effort. Four out of the five permanent members of the Security Council during the Cold War were totally against Iran, and the fifth one, China, was neutral. So the Soviet Union and the United States found themselves on the same side. The Secretary General of the United Nations, he was the only one who did anything. He sent teams of chemical weapons experts to the region. They came back, they reported, they said all the right things, and nobody paid attention.
What about the Reagan administration? What was its position on this?
Well, the Reagan administration was in a difficult position. They hated the Iranian regime, and they didn't like the Iraqi regime, but they saw them as a lesser evil. And so they basically gave a green light to Iraq's chemical weapons use. But this, when Saddam Hussein went overboard and gassed an entire town of Kurds, then the Reagan administration was highly embarrassed and had to cover up, essentially.
But up until then, it was kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, even if I don't like this person.
Yeah, they held their noses, basically, but they went along.
And then you say because Saddam then gassed his own people, that was going too far. Now, why would he gas his own people?
Well, his own people being, in this case, the Kurds of Iraq, and there were Kurdish guerrilla parties that had been fighting for Kurdish independence for a long time, which clearly was not a regime interest, but during the Iran-Iraq war also had decided to side with the Iranian enemy. And in March of 1988, a force of Iranian fighters and Kurdish fighters entered Iraq at Halabja and took control over the area. And this is what, of course, went way too far for the regime.
But then the gassing also took the lives of civilians. How did the United States manage to make public statements that condemn the targeting of civilians without actually making reference to gas?
Well, no, they did make reference to gas, in all honesty. And when the story of Halabja broke, there was an immediate response, and everybody realized, I think, that it was Iraq. And it was condemned, and it was on Nightline and this and that. For a little while, there was a lot of publicity. But then this story emerged that, in fact, maybe, yes, Iraq had done this, but also Iran had used gas in Halabja. And then it became sort of like, well, a plague on both your houses, you know, you're both evil, and so let's denounce both of you. And it diffused the whole issue of responsibility.
Had Iran used gas as well?
In Halabja, definitely not. And during the war, I have found no persuasive evidence to suggest that it did. It may have done so experimentally, but I'm yet to be persuaded.
But Saddam claimed that Iran had used the gas.
Well, actually, it was mostly Washington that did that. The Iraqis were sort of came as seconds. They only took their cue from the Reagan administration.
And the Reagan administration simply was doing it because it was supporting the Iraqi government against Iran? Was there nothing deeper here? I mean, they were trying to get to broker a ceasefire, weren't they?
Yes, but on really Iraqi terms. And of course, there was a debate within the Reagan administration. There were the people who were concerned about proliferation, who were dead set against this. But they were overridden by the geostrategists who feared an Islamic revolution spreading throughout the Gulf, where, of course, the oil is.
We were also giving tactical support to the Iraqis, weren't we? Telling them where Iranian troops were moving and where to attack.
Satellite intelligence was shared with the Iraqis, and this helped them tremendously in directing their chemical fire.
And then along comes the Iran-Contra affair. Well, let's take a little break and we'll come back to that. My guest is Joost R. Hilterman. His book, A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja, is published by Cambridge University Press. Stay with us. My guest is Joost R. Hilterman, a Middle East analyst who's worked with Human Rights Watch and is currently Deputy Program Director for the Middle East for the International Crisis Group. He's written a book called A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja. It is published by Cambridge University Press. Before we get to Iran-Contra, what were groups like Human Rights Watch doing at this time?
Well, Human Rights Watch was not involved in Middle East work in the 1980s, so it did nothing when that happened. But it did something right afterwards. Its Middle East program began in 1989, and one of the first reports they did was on Iraq. And so that was very good. Amnesty International was covering it, but because of the problem of access to the area, it was very difficult to do any kind of definitive reporting. And so, essentially, very little was done.
The official American policy was to try to prevent Iran from buying weapons. So how did the U.S.-Iraqi relations change in the wake of the Iran-Contra affair once it became public knowledge that the U.S. had been covertly selling arms to Iran?
Well, the Iraqis felt totally betrayed, and it really did affect their war effort, because what the United States had sold Iran via Israel was Hawk missiles, which made it very difficult, which was basically the main weapon against the Iraqi Air Force, of course, which had so far had total superiority in the air. And it forced the Iraqi planes to fly higher, and this was an unintended consequence, as a result of which, when they threw out the chemicals, they would disperse over a much larger field and in fact affect the Iraqi soldiers. And so one of the effects of the sale of this weapon was also that the chemical warfare changed in nature.
Did the U.S. try to rebuild its relationship with Iraq?
Well, it did. For one thing, it replaced the CIA, which had been sort of the main agency in Baghdad, with the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA. And then it stepped up its economic support, and it promised to broker a ceasefire in the war on Iraqi terms. And so the tilt toward Iraq became more pronounced after Iran-Contra.
When did Donald Rumsfeld make that famous visit to Saddam Hussein?
That was before that, yeah. He made two visits to Saddam Hussein in December 1983. And 3 months later, he visited Baghdad once more. And chemical weapons were raised, but not in any serious way. And in fact, on the second visit, Rumsfeld made clear to the Iraqis that when the State Department had condemned Iraq for the use of a nerve agent, that it wasn't Iraq that was being targeted as part of this criticism, but that the United States had made a general statement about how bad it was to use chemical weapons.
Now, the war ended in a stalemate, but did our help to Iraq or our help to Iran play more of a role in creating that situation?
No, in the end, in the final year, it was the United States' support of Iraq that proved decisive. And the Iranians certainly read it that way. When an Iranian Airbus was fired down, an accident or not, from the Iranian perspective, this was an American signal that they meant business and, you know, the regime's time was up.
The United States brought down an airplane that we claimed that we thought it originally was a warplane, and it turned out to be a civilian transport.
That's right. So that was one thing. And also the intelligence sharing, especially satellite intelligence, was stepped up in the final months of the war. And so from the Iranian point of view, the Americans had decisively put their weight behind Iraq.
Did we do anything to prevent Iraq from buying the substances it needed to manufacture chemical weapons?
Well, yes. In fact, from 1984 on, there was a U.S. ban on the sale of precursor agents to both Iran and Iraq. And this ban was serious. But, you know, there were many illicit channels of getting these kinds of precursor agents to Iraq. And in fact, a Dutch businessman was recently convicted to 15 years in jail for crimes against humanity as being responsible for shipping these agents.
Because they are considered international war crimes to use chemical weapons and biological weapons?
Yeah, absolutely. These are war crimes, and when you use them against civilians, they're definitely crimes against humanity.
Did Iran manage to get the UN or the U.S. government to investigate Iraq's war crimes?
Well, the United Nations Secretary General ordered these investigations by chemical experts. So, there were these investigations.
Because it was the Geneva Protocol of 1925 that banned chemical weapons. And I would have thought that everybody would have jumped on that a lot earlier once they knew that chemical weapons were being used.
Only the Secretary General of the United Nations undertook any action of any sort. And to his great credit, because he stuck his neck out and he couldn't do anything beyond that. But he did that, and the results were crystal clear for anyone to read.
It obviously emboldened Saddam Hussein, and it's one of the reasons perhaps that he could continue gassing his own people, the Kurds, because the West was repeatedly looking the other way.
Especially after Halabja, when he realized that there was going to be no condemnation of his regime's particular behavior in Halabja, gassing an entire town, he then did two things. One, he used gas on the first day of every stage of the counterinsurgency campaign called the Anfal, which terrified the rural population who ran from their homes to the main paved roads where they were collected up by the Iraqi military, shipped off to detention centers, and from there to execution sites in the western desert where they were massacred. And the second thing is that also in an Iraqi offensive in the Iran-Iraq war, it was the first one of the war, they used gas again massively on the first day of every stage of five stages, and they terrified the Iranians, who by now had basically wised up to the fact that they were not going to win this war. And moreover, Saddam Hussein threatened to put chemical warheads on the Scud missiles, which by now were reaching Tehran. And Tehran, in April 1988, emptied out, totally emptied out. People were terrified, and it totally undermined people's support for the war.
This brings us to Chemical Ali. Can you tell us about him?
Well, Ali Hassan al-Majid, who is named Chemical Ali by the Kurds in particular, was Saddam Hussein's cousin and also his main henchman. He was put in charge of the counterinsurgency campaign called the Anfal, in which at least 80,000 Kurds were systematically murdered. And he did it to a large extent by terrifying people with chemical weapons and flushing them out of the countryside. So that's where he got his name. Later, he was the governor of occupied Kuwait, and he was defense minister. And he just now was on trial and has been sentenced to die. His conviction is now being appealed, but he's almost certain to follow his cousin in death.
Didn't the Kurds, to some degree, bring this upon themselves? I mean, they saw this as an opportunity to promote their independent liberation movement, but they risked appearing to be foreign proxies for the Iranian government.
It's a very good point. Certainly, Arab Iraqis see it that way. But even within the Kurdish community, there is a debate over the wisdom of having brought the Iranians into the Halabja area and thereby triggered the Iraqi reprisal. Now, everybody knew that Iraq would not let this stand, but they probably hadn't expected the ferocity of the response.
How did Halabja's geographic position make it attractive as a battleground for the Iranians against the Iraqis?
Well, the Halabja town is lying in a basin behind mountains that form the border with Iran, and in front of a river and a lake that essentially cut it off from the rest of Kurdistan. And so the Iranians, what they did was they came across the mountain, they came down the hillsides, they took over the Iranian artillery positions on the hilltops and let the Kurdish guerrillas go into the town of Halabja. Nabja. And then they drove these Iraqi soldiers toward the lake. Many drowned there. Others were captured. And they occupied the area. And even after the gas attack, the Iranians were never attacked by the Iraqis, stayed there for 4 months, and then when the war ended, withdrew.
Didn't the Iranian account of the battle differ from the Kurdish one?
Well, the Iranians made it appear as if the Kurds were, you know, mere auxiliaries who barely played a role. Well, the Kurds...
Because they wanted it to look like an Iranian victory.
Absolutely, in the war. Well, the Kurds, the Kurdish commanders, very much wanted to play up their own role in liberating their own people by, you know, evicting the Ba'ath Party and the security police from the town of Halabja. Who had suffered very grievously under the regime through the destruction that happened a year earlier. But now they're a lot more careful about what their own role was, and they said, well, maybe we were being manipulated by the Iranians when we went into Halabja. You know, obviously there was something embarrassing that happened.
Can you describe the devastation of the gas attack itself?
Well, you know, it came as a surprise to most people, and it caught them unawares in their daily affairs, cooking at home, driving out in the street, going to the market. It was very sudden, instant death, especially the use of nerve agents. You know, it leaves you no chance if you're exposed to them. But the wind is a fickle thing, and so many people managed to get away simply because they were in the right place. And they escaped. They managed to get to straggle to the border. They got to Iran. They retreated there, and they ended up in refugee camps. Everybody else was left behind and basically frozen into place until journalists came into the city a week later and took the pictures that have become famous.
My guest is Joost R. Hilterman, Joost Hilterman. His book, A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja, published by Cambridge University Press. So journalists came in, and then didn't the United Nations send in an investigator?
Nope, they couldn't do it because the United Nations very much observes the principle of sovereignty. So they could go to Iran, they could go to Iraq, but they could not go from Iran into occupied Halabja if the Iraqi regime would not give permission. And of course, they were not going to give that, given the fact that the Iraqi regime had gassed the people in Halabja. So they couldn't go there.
So what happened at the UN? Did anybody condemn this?
Eventually, 2 months later, the Security Council got itself to condemn the attack in Halabja, but it named both countries as perpetrators implicitly, and it called on both countries to desist from using chemical weapons.
That obviously is a political decision. You said earlier that the Reagan administration tried to make it look as if Iran had used the gas in Halabja.
That's right.
And that was simply a way of saying that we are once again supporting Iraq. Iran-Contra is behind us?
Well, they were trying to diffuse the criticism that was bound to come if Iraq was seen as the sole culprit in this case.
But we also were sending a message that Iraq could act with impunity.
Absolutely. And it did. It proceeded with the Anfal campaign, using gas on the first day of every stage of that campaign. Extremely effective in terrifying the villagers.
Talk about the Anfal campaign. That was a systematized program, it seems, to eradicate the Kurds, wasn't it?
Well, to eradicate the insurgency by eradicating the countryside.
So it wasn't a true genocide?
It was a true genocide in the sense, according to the language of the Genocide Convention, where you need to show intent to eliminate a population in whole or in part. And in this case, it was the rural population.
Was this during the war, or is this after the war was over?
It started in the final months of the war and extended until after the war had ended.
What happened to the people who managed to flee from the gassed areas?
Well, people who could fled to the border, either Iran or Turkey, and got out. Many others fled to the nearest paved road and were there gathered up by the Iraqi forces. So they didn't manage to escape at all.
And how many people were killed in these Anfal camps?
We don't know the exact numbers. At Human Rights Watch, the number we came to was at least 80,000, but the Kurds themselves say at least 100,000 more.
Did Saddam Hussein give a rationale for the Anfal campaigns?
Sure, he said the Kurdish guerrillas were a fifth column that was fighting with the Iranian enemy in an existential battle over Iraq. And so they betrayed the country and the nation, and they ought to be punished. What they didn't say was that they were actually punishing the civilian population by killing them.
Did the world know that Anfal was more than just a counterinsurgency campaign?
Apparently not. I think that became known much later. The full extent, what was known at the time was that civilians were being trucked out of the Kurdish areas into other parts of Iraq. And people thought that, just as in previous campaigns, because this wasn't the first one, that people were being encamped somewhere on the Saudi border. But in fact, they were taken to execution sites.
What happened at the end of the war? Did it end in a stalemate, or did Iraq gain some Iranian territory?
No, it was total stalemate, back to the same positions that they had been before the war, with so nothing gained and huge losses.
Because so many people had died.
So many people.
It's amazing to me that the Iranian country has maintained so much stability since, because I would have thought that many people who'd lost a loved one would be furious with the tactics of the human waves.
Well, there is a debate also in Iran. There's a very important debate, but it doesn't come out very well, about the wisdom of having pursued the Iraqis after Iraqi forces were expelled from Iranian territory in 1982, 2 years after the start of the war.
It could have just ended it.
Could have ended right there. And the pragmatists sort of were in favor of that, but the radicals in Iran said, to the contrary, this is our chance to bring down the Saddam regime.
But Iran also repeatedly requested that the UN send teams to investigate the use of gas by Iraq. Did Iran have any standing at the UN as a petitioner for human rights in the light of its own human rights abuses?
No, this was the big problem they faced. I mean, Iran was its own worst enemy. It was very good in airing these complaints. And I must say, having gone through all the correspondence to the UN from this period, they were presenting extremely sophisticated legal and human rights arguments to make that case. But there was no one willing to listen to the Iranians, because the Iranians had kidnapped or taken Americans hostage and had, of course, committed all kinds of abuses themselves.
But the UN here is just doing something that we have seen in any number of other instances in the former Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, where it says, oh, this is terrible, but then doesn't do anything. I'm not sure the UN could have done anything, but I would have hoped that it could have.
Well, the United Nations.
Darfur is a case right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it comes down to the political will of the international community, whatever that may be. And when you have four permanent members out of five against you, then there's not going to be any action on your behalf.
But still, the UN has these laws. And I'd imagine if these laws aren't enforced, then they just become weakened to the point of being useless.
Well, we've seen over the last two or three decades the gradual weakening of the United Nations as a credible institution in mediating disputes and in intervening in wars. And I think this is just one example where the credibility of the United Nations was dangerously undermined.
What is the legacy of all of this today? Are there chemical weapons being developed in the Middle East?
Well, there are a number of countries that have that are suspected of having chemical weapons programs. We've even seen the use of crude chemical weapons by al-Qaeda in Iraq in the last couple of years. And so the issue is still very much alive. And there are many other sort of instances of blowback, if you want, from these events in the 1980s. I mean, look at the Kurdish psychology. Why are they pressing for independence? They cannot live with any Iraqi government. There will never be any trust. They will just know that sooner or later they're going to get clobbered again in the way that they were. And same for Iran.
The U.S. largely ignored Iraq's use of weapons of mass destruction during the Iran-Iraq war, and then made a big issue of them in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq later. So
it's totally hypocritical.
Is it just hypocrisy, or is it perhaps that we learned a lesson?
I'd like to think that, but I'm not so sure. I mean, here was George Bush proclaiming Saddam Hussein a man who gassed his own people. He was right, but who was behind the man who gassed his own people?
And you're saying the United States and the West in
gave
general.
Gave the green light.
Joost R. Hilterman's book, A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja, is published by Cambridge University Press. And it sets the stage for all the terrible things that we've seen in the Middle East ever since. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, a psychologist tells about the underestimated role that emotion plays in politics. And then we'll take a look at how Queen Elizabeth I managed to keep the British economy afloat through naval exploration. Also, Sarah Rule discusses her new version of Eurydice, and Please Explain is all about the chemistry of contraceptives. By the way, if you've missed something on the show and just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Sophie Rand, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Jay Cowett was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.